Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
The history of music is based on human interaction. We know that we see two people who are communicating to each other, sitting next to each other, texting each other. When you think about it, if we are going to be able to report the human condition at any point in history through the music of a particular composer, we have to understand what that human condition is. And if we're not communicating with people, how are we going to do that? I mean, we're all method actors. How do we communicate pain if we've never felt pain?
Hi there, everybody. This is Jeremy. I just wanted to hop in and clear up so there's no confusion. This is the first half of an interview we did with my teacher, Wes Kenny. The episode that we released 2 weeks ago on Christmas Day was the second half of the interview. I decided to do them out of order so that we could talk about his Christmas decorations for a little bit of Christmas episode, since that came out on Christmas Day. We're going to talk a lot about the class that Maestro teaches at CSU, as well as some of the work he did on his sabbatical. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Wes Kenny. Probably actually start with you just kind of giving an overview of who you are, where you come from, what you do.
Well, my name is Wes Kenny, and I am the director of orchestras at Colorado State University, and jointly with the Fort Collins Symphony, where I am music director. And I'm in my 15th season now, came to Fort Collins, Colorado in 2003. And in addition, I'm also the music director of Opera Fort Collins. And then a little more recently, the music director of the Denver Young Artists Orchestra, which is the premier youth orchestra in the state of Colorado. Prior to that, I was actually on the faculty at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. And while I was doing that, I was also the associate conductor of the Virginia Symphony, where I had started in 1997. So that's the recent history. So, you know, with the Colorado State University, I conduct all the orchestra concerts as well as the opera productions. And with Opera Fort Collins, anywhere from 2 to 3 productions a year. With that, Fort Collins Symphony does 5 masterworks, a major pops concert. We do educational programs. The Fort Collins Symphony is also in the pit for the local ballet company's Nutcracker. We do 5 performances with that. And then also at Colorado State, I teach graduate conducting. And usually have one graduate teaching assistant who is, or an orchestral conductor who studies with me during that time. And that keeps me pretty busy.
That sounds like it.
Yeah. And so the conducting class, could we start out talking about that?
Sure.
Because it was a hell of a class. It was not easy.
Yeah.
When I came in, you know, I was kind of thinking, oh, you know, group conducting class, that won't be too bad. But it was
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. You know, we've had a lot of people go through the class, and it's interesting because, you know, sometimes they're conducting majors, and, you know, we have graduates who are both in choral and band come into the class. And then we also get some graduate music education majors. And I think for all of them, they feel like they've put a lot into the class and then they get a lot out of the class. I just had a contact from a student from a couple of years ago who was being complimented by some students in an orchestra that he had never conducted before about his conducting. And he said that he always thinks back to the class that he took with me that helped him kind of learn a little bit more about the craft. And of course, you know, that class, a big part of it is learning how to study a score, creating a system on how to study a score and becoming efficient at it, because I truly believe that people who feel like score study is really, really hard, then they won't do it. They won't do it to the level that they need to. And so, you know, I always tell the class that, you know, this, here's a system I want you to follow while you're in the class. But of course, depending on what your strengths are, you're going to change that focus, you know, depending on what you do best. So, you know, as I pointed out, you know, if you're a jazzer and hear harmonic changes easily, you may not need to do as stringent a harmonic analysis. If you hear colors really well, then maybe you might not have to do as much of a melodic analysis. But in any case, you know, I use the 7 trips to the score, which is something that was developed at the Belgian National Conservatory originally, and then I've tweaked it over the years as I've used it. And so with each of the trips, you're supposed to peel off another layer of the score, but it basically gets you to focus on one thing at a time. And I've had score studies seminars that I've been part of where, you know, we're supposed to be looking at the Beethoven 8th Symphony, and then we never get off the first page. And I don't know about anybody else, but, you know, my life would be a whole lot more complicated if I've spent 8 hours on just one page of score. I wouldn't be able to do some of the things that I do now. Also in the class, you know, we start off with some basic stick technique just to see where people are, some conducting exercises, where it's a point of discovery to see what the level is of each of the students in the class. And then after that, we start diving into repertoire and, you know, we learn about, you know, how to cue, how to breathe, how to use, you know, our hands in the most efficient way possible, independency of hands, ways to conduct dynamics that you're not necessarily having to conduct bigger and smaller, but change your conducting space in the process. You know, we delve into how to tell a story with our hands as we're conducting the music as a point of inspiration. We go through two rounds of that. The first round is just sitting in a chair and doing some sort of story as you're listening to the Brahms Hungarian Dance Number 5. And then when we come around again, you're now actually conducting real repertoire. You do either the opening of Richard Strauss' Death and Transfiguration, or the opening of Also Sprach Zarathustra, the famous fanfare, or the opening of Johann Strauss's The Blue Danube. And in each case, I mean, it's the idea is for you to, you know, really tell a story now while you're actually conducting a piece. And of course, we go through Le Bon method as a way to communicate with our hands. We learn non-binding resistance as far as the use of orchestral sound. I put people into a swimming pool at that point and make them learn what that feels like. We go through asymmetrical meters. We conduct some Stravinsky. We conduct some Copland. And eventually we end up in recitative, where we actually have them learn a major recitative out of the magic flute. And then the semester winds up with some sessions in front of the orchestra, the CSU Symphony, depending on what we're doing that year. This year it'll be some of the movements from Prokofiev's Lieutenant Kiji Suite. But in the past it's been Brahms' Third Symphony. If I recall, Jeremy, you actually had some hands-on with Brahms' 3 first movement.
Yeah, it was terrifying.
Yeah, everybody's got to tackle it at some point if you're going to really make your way in the conducting world, it's a real test there. Yeah. But you know, I think my favorite ending exercise for the class is what's called the silent final, where I give everybody in the class, you get excerpts from four pieces that are all in 4/4 time, all at the same tempo. And on the day of the final, you reach into a hat and you pull out a piece of paper, and it gives you 3 out of the 4 excerpts in a particular order. And then you come into the room, and in front of the conducting faculty, you have to convince them which piece you're conducting, and there is no sound. It's just by showing what it is that you're conducting, because ultimately what we want you to do is to look like the music that you're conducting. And as I said, you know, it's just, I think that oftentimes the class feels like it's a daunting task when I kind of describe it at the beginning of the semester. But by the time you get to the end of the semester, if you've kind of followed the steps of the training that we've been talking about, it's really not that big of a deal. So, and yeah, it's an intense class. I really enjoy teaching it. I particularly as people discover things about themselves in the process. Very cool.
Well, there's also a couple observation, rehearsal and performance observation papers,
right?
as well as all the Dale Carnegie stuff.
Oh yeah, the Dale Carnegie. I think a lot of people raise their eyebrows when they hear that the Dale Carnegie book is one of the required textbooks for the class. But, you know, in today's day and age where we are trying to bury the notion of the browbeating conductor who gets the job done through intimidation, the Dale Carnegie book is a very, very useful tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know I've suggested to Luke and a couple other people. I mean, it's not too long. It's an easy read, but it's a very impactful little tome of wisdom.
And I think, Jeremy, as you might remember, that one of the things that Dale Carnegie says at the beginning of the book is that not only will you need to read this book, but you will need to reread this book and continue to reread this book to remind you of the tenets that are in, you know, in the book that, you know, as he describes, because it's very, very useful. And just being in the business, you know, it's like a file on your skills as far as, you know, interacting with people. Mm-hmm. And, people oftentimes ask me, you know, what is the most difficult part of my job as a music director? And I will tell them that it's dealing with personnel, because, you know, musicians, you know, they do not live an easy life, and it takes their toll on people in many different ways. And, you know, you get into situations where an orchestra begins to grow and, you know, somebody within the orchestra is not growing along with it. And you start running into some very, very challenging situations that you have to address. Mm-hmm. And knowing the Dale Carnegie skill certainly helps with that. Not that it necessarily makes it easy. So.
Mm-hmm. And actually, when we were sending you questions, I had forgotten totally about the Summer Masters Institute.
Right.
That whole fantastic program. Could you talk about
that? Yeah, so I'm one of the founders, and about 10, 11 years ago, we really, as online classes were starting to become available, we started a program that is primarily for music educators that allows them to study at CSU for 3 summers and then take classes online throughout the rest of the school year. And the focus is primarily on conducting. And it's wonderful. We hire professional musicians for choral, orchestra, and band, and everybody goes through all 3 disciplines. We have 3 master teachers, and of course I do the orchestra, but it's been a wonderful program, and we have graduated quite a few people who are all over the world at this point, and people come to the program from all over the world. So very excited about that program is going strong. And, you know, we have the final project is a team-conducted Broadway musical or operetta of some sort. Everybody gets about 45 pages of the score. And it's quite a sight to behold for the audience. I think they come just to see who's going to pop out of the pit next.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's it's great for people. I know, and there are some people who kind of take it in stride, and then there are some people who are terrified with the project because they've never ever done anything like this. And I think one of the reasons why we give them a project is because it's kind of a culmination of working with winds, working with strings, and working with voices. And so you learn a lot. And we've done some pretty high powered projects over the years. You know, we've done several Gilbert and Sullivan works, but we've also done The Secret Garden. We've done The Merry Widow, which, you know, these are not easy pieces to conduct. And so people learn a lot from the process. And of course, you know, the idea with all this is that when you're at a school and you're going to have your school musical, that you have the skills to say, I would like to do it this year. And that you have the skills to do just that.
Yeah, the Mikado production was a lot of fun.
Yes, indeed.
We had a visiting bat this summer.
Yes.
A visiting bat?
Yeah.
It was
Brian, one of our stage director, went and caught it during the rehearsal.
Oh, did he get it?
Yeah, he got it and he took it out.
You know, one of the things that we have discovered, it's not the first time that we've had bats in Griffin, and that is it's evidently the old Fort Collins High School is part of the migratory pattern of bats in the area. That's how we end up with bats inside. I mean, just go figure.
Yeah. Well, we had one during Fledermaus last year also.
That's right.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah, that Fledermaus is one that, you know, we may end up at some point doing Fledermaus as part of the summer project as well.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there are some numbers in there that are really challenging.
Yeah, I'm thinking the, the Countess's homeland aria.
Oh, the Chardash?
Yeah, the Chardash.
Yes, the opening of that is challenging. The Watch duet is also very challenging.
Yeah.
So I have a question. You were talking about in your brief discussion on score study, you had mentioned harmonic analysis, and then you mentioned that if someone was, you know, good with color, they might have an easier time with melodic analysis. What do you mean by that? Melodic analysis.
Okay, so with it. In one of the trips of the seven trips of the score, in a melodic analysis, you're going through and I ask students to actually notate who has the melody. And I use the notation that Arnold Schoenberg used to use for his 12-tone pieces. So it's kind of an H with a long line on, you know, off of one of the top end corners of the H. And that stands for Hauptstimme or main voice. And then the same thing for Nebenstimme. So you use an N, which is the secondary voice if there's a counter melody. And so you go through and you identify the tune. And basically what a melodic analysis allows you to do is to balance your ensemble. Because going through and creating a mind's ear of the score, you determine what you want to hear most. And so as you're standing in front of the ensemble and you are you're rehearsing it so that it actually reflects what your mind's ear is hearing. That's when you're making adjustments in the dynamics. And of course, you know, it's just, you know, things change over the years depending on who wrote the piece. But of course, you know, with a Beethoven piece where he gives everybody the same dynamic, absolutely you have to make adjustments if the piece is going to work. But of course, you know, those adjustments that you're making most likely are going to be based upon performance practices of the day. Because, you know, that's, you know, they would have assumed that, or Beethoven would have assumed that these people knew what they were doing, and that if the brass are given double forte and the woodwinds have the tune at double forte, that the brass are going to win that battle unless the brass, after the initial attack, actually back down several notches in the dynamic so that you can actually hear the melodic content that's above them. So okay. That's what I mean by, you know, by a melodic analysis. And, you know, when I go through a harmonic analysis, I'm less interested in functional harmony, you know, or Roman numerals because, you know, that's, I mean, yes, it's helpful for you to learn the piece, but in a harmonic analysis, I'm much more interested in verticalities because as you are trying to tune your ensemble or you're listening for wrong notes, if you know the chord, because you've already gone through it, it makes it a whole lot easier to identify what notes you should be hearing and what. So, you know, and it's just, I mean, as an example, and we're doing, you know, we're doing Poulenc this evening, the organ concerto, but in his Gloria, in the last movement of the Gloria, he writes a major minor tonality where, you know, both the major and the minor third are present. And, you know, if you don't know that, you hear something that sounds awfully sour, kind of a shock. And in fact, when we did the piece a bunch of years ago and the music is a rental, you know, we hit that downbeat and the orchestra just played a nice A major chord. And I, you know, I had to stop and say, wait, did anybody have a C natural that's been corrected to a C sharp? And a bunch of hands went up and I go, that's not correct. It's supposed to be what you have. And they were kind of astounded when I had corrected this thing into actually dissonance as opposed to the consonant that they had played the first time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that you discover when you do a vertical harmonic analysis of the score. And, you know, we also say that, you know, if the harmonies are not complicated, you really don't need to do a chord by chord analysis. But it's places where things do get complicated that you might actually have to do, you know, a blow by blow just to know exactly what's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the Mozart exposition doesn't really need quite as much attention as the
development. That's right. Yeah, well, I mean, if the harmonies are, you know, if the harmonic rhythm is not, you know, not going very fast, you know, it's, there's no reason to sit there and, as I said, do a blow by blow. Mm-hmm. Now.
So with the seven trips, I don't think we've ever talked about this. Like in, if you're doing a multi-movement work or even something as, you know, as big as an opera, would you do kind of one trip through the entire piece or do sections of it at a time and build up?
That's a good question.
The opera.
And, you know, I think that, you know, you're, and of course, as I said, the, you know, the seven trips is designed to peel off a certain layer of, you know, of the score. So for that first trip, the instrumentation, chances are I'd go, if it was a multi-movement symphony, I would do that first trip through all the movements. Mm-hmm. Just so that I can see, you know, how they compare to each other. You know, are the trombones, for example, in a Brahms symphony, which movements are they playing on? You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, and as we've talked about, the practical application there is who should be at the rehearsal if you're doing a rehearsal schedule. You know, that's so, you know, that's, you know, obviously if you're planning on doing the second and third movements of a symphony, the trombones only play in the first and fourth, you know, they should not be called to that rehearsal. So that's, you know, these are the kinds of things that you discover. And then the second trip, which are major transitions for an opera, I'll go through the entire opera. That you're also marking in tempo markings at that point. You know, I'm going to go through and I'm going to mark in beat patterns for everything. And of course, you know, you're always doing it in pencil so that you certainly are entitled to change your mind, because, you know, as we know that you don't know how to conduct a piece of music until you actually start conducting it. Mm-hmm. And you discover things, about the piece. But, you know, once you start getting into things like, form, then chances are, you know, I'll start maybe staying with one movement at a time, you know, to do the form, to do the harmonic analysis, to do the phrasal analysis, to do the melodic analysis, and so on and so forth. You know, and unless there's something that I want to know that is in comparison to other movements. So, for example, if I happen to know that the symphony is cyclic and the melody comes back, then I might, you know, go to the other movements where some of the elements are showing up again and see how they are in comparison. But it's a good question. And I think that, you know, for the opera, you know, if the opera is in acts, then chances are I'll stick with one act, of the opera. Unless there's, you know, again, there's something that, you know, is in, subsequent spots that I need to see a comparison.
So what are the seven passes?
Okay. Like, all right. So that's a good question. So the first pass is instrumentation. And one of the things I ask my students to do is on the top of every page, put in the code of that instrumentation. So, you know, if it's three flutes, three oboes, three clarinets, three bassoons, then you're going to put 3-3-3-3 or 3-3-1 for the brass, timpani plus how many percussion do you need? Is there piano, harp, and then strings? And, you know, as I said, you know, it's, and one of the things I oftentimes say is that, you know, don't mark your score for this performance, mark it for the performance you're going to do in 5 years from now. So it's really clear and easy to read so that you can come back and see exactly what you did. You know, I think one of the questions that you said to me is, you know, what are some things that young conductors, you know, are not doing right now? And I don't think they're thinking enough into the future for themselves. That, you know, when you prepare a piece of music, you do not want to have to do that over again. Mm-hmm. So you want to do it thoroughly and clearly so it's useful to you. And, you know, I have this sense that, you know, particularly with young conductors, that they believe themselves to be invincible. So they'll put down chicken scratch what they can read right now and says, oh, yeah, I'll remember that. In 5 years, you are not going to remember what that means. You're going to stare at that and says, what was I thinking, you know, at that point? So yeah. You do it neatly. And the second trip is major transitions. And, you know, so, you know, anything that changes the flow of the music. Those are beat patterns, fermatas, lifts, cutoffs, anything that, as I said, changes the flow of the music. And that's also where you're going to make adjustments in tempo. And I ask my students to put a metronome mark on everything that they do. And we spend time training them to remember tempos. For a lot of young conductors, you know, you may not realize that the way that you learned intervals by attaching it to a melody that you knew very well, you can do that the same way with tempos. So that, you know, if there's a song that you absolutely know how it goes, then you can put a metronome mark to that. Then, you know, you will eventually develop the feel of a number and what that tempo should be. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, we all know Bolero. We know the snare drum part that, if you sing the snare drum part precisely, that you're going to be going about a quarter note equals 72. And and once you have 72, then of course you also have 144 and you have 36. So I tell people to put metronome markings and everything that they can actually read while standing over the score. So that's the second pass. Then the third pass is form. And of course, you know, form, a lot of it is going to be based upon, at least for starters, you know, a hypothesis. You know, if you're doing the first movement of Beethoven symphony, chances are you're saying, well, this must be a sonata allegro approach to form. Okay. So that then you're going to go and prove and disprove that. But of course, as you get into the second movement of a Beethoven symphony, all bets go off because he wrote a lot of different forms for second movement, and even the same thing for the last movements. So, but you know, if you're doing something that may not have a stock form, then you might actually have to create one. You know, so our class goes, one of the analysis we did were a couple movements out of the Ravel Mother Goose Suite. Okay. And, you know, there's, you know, it might have a form if you make an argument for it, but if you write a form that's, you know, A, B, A, C, D, E, F, that's okay, you know, as long as you have a concept of how the music is flowing, okay? Also knowing the form, you know, helps you find climaxes in the piece and will also help inform you on how to pace a piece of music, okay? Then the fourth trip through the score is a harmonic analysis, and you might actually have to do the fourth trip before you complete the third, because sometimes music is being driven by harmonies, you know, in key areas, such as, you know, the 18th century symphony. So, you know, but that's what you're doing there. Then the fifth trip to the score is a phrasal analysis. And I ask students to break the music into phrases no larger than 4-bar phrases. And yes, I know there are phrases that are longer than 4 bars, but when you mark your score with heavy lines, your eye can only pick up 4 bars or smaller. If you try to do a 6-bar phrase, you're not going to be able to see it. So a 5-bar phrase could be broken into 3 and 2. A 6-bar phrase could be broken into 4 and 2, you know, something like that. Anyway, but you go through and you actually mark heavy lines in your score with a pencil, of course. And, you know, and it actually breaks up the score to the visual. And it actually helps you get your eyes out of the score because now you're looking at things in much larger chunks. Okay. And so you do not have to worry about when your eyes go back in the score of not knowing where you are. You know, and then it's particularly useful in a movement that's in one. It's like the Beethoven scherzos. You know, you might have 18 bars on one page, and it's impossible to not take your eyes out and be able to go back and see exactly where you are unless you've broken things down a bit on that. And then if you might even go further by combining phrases, which actually in being able to memorize a piece of music, what you're actually memorizing is the phrase structure. So I'll have them, for example, I'll have them write something like 3 times 4, which means that there are 3 4-bar phrases coming up that are similar to each other. Or I'll have them write a 4+2. There's a 4-bar phrase and then a 2-bar phrase that are, you know, combined for each other. And so that's the phrasal analysis. And then there's a melodic analysis, which is used for determining where the melody is, counter melody, harmonies, accompaniment, we should say. And then in addition to that, you may be marking where instruments are entering, so for cueing sake. And then lastly, you go through and you start looking at dynamics. And I use a color coding system on the dynamics where I ask people to actually purchase a red and a blue pencil that is on either side. You know, evidently dentists use these pencils, but you can find them in any art store. But the reason I have them do that is because with a couple of rulers, you know, you will, all loud dynamics, mezzo forte and on up, and all soft dynamics, mezzo piano and down, you'll either write mark with red or blue, and I have people bracket things. And as you're doing this as one trip to the score, be able to have that pencil in your hand and just be able to flip it over as you need to, you actually are going to save yourself a lot of time. Because, as I said, you can buy a red and a blue pencil, but just by the act of putting one down to picking another up, it may only take a second, but I want you to think of the number of markings that go into a score. And you start adding up those seconds, and those seconds are going to become minutes, and those minutes are going to become hours. And, you know, the whole point of this is to become extraordinarily efficient in what you're doing. And I have to say that when I was with the Virginia Symphony, you know, I went from, my career started with youth orchestras. And when I left the San Francisco Bay Area, what I was doing, and I got to the Virginia Symphony, the number of scores I was supposed to know increased by tenfold. And I really wish at that point that I had the system available to me, because I actually developed the system in the last 15 years. And, you know, it has served me well. And as I said, you know, people will go off and eventually mark their scores, you know, as they will. But at least if you're efficient about it, you'll get it done. You'll do the work. If it's too hard, you won't do it. You know, got other things to do. Yeah. Those are the 7 trips to the score. Then, you know, it really depends on what kind of work it is. If there's voices, you may want to look at the tessitura of the range of the voices, cutoffs for diction. You know, there's articulation. I ask people to take a yellow highlighter and mark accents and forzandi because that becomes extraordinarily visual to you on the page, and it's something that goes directly into your hands. There's there's a variety of things that, you know, you need to do. And, you know, and the one thing that I always say is that, and I kind of compare it to doing a Sudoku puzzle, that, you know, if you use the same system for every Sudoku puzzle, there are some that you will solve quickly, and then there will some that will take you longer because you need to use a different system. And so every piece of music is different. So even though the system that you use may be fine for most of the music, you're going to encounter music that you're going to have to do something else. You know, so for example, if you do something that is, you know, very much an aleatoric piece, or, you know, something by Penderecki, you're going to have to figure out a different set of markings to make that work, okay, and mm-hmm. take an approach.
Yeah, okay. I can upload a scan of my page, because we've also got a conducting anthology, and so I have a bunch of right. notes on that score study page that I've taken, so I can yep. post that when we
yeah. post so, the episode. Just a little story on the effectiveness of this system. I had a girl take my class, and when she finished her master's degree, she went to the University of Southern California for a doctorate. And she gets into a class, and this is kind of a pre-screening of students who are in the program. And they hand everybody a score, and they say, you have 15 minutes to prepare the score. Some choral score of some sort. And she was the only one who finished the project. Because she says, I know how to do this. And, you know, it was like boom, 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 boom through the, you know, the various, you know, trips to the score, and she was done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and everybody else was still struggling. But part of it is because, you know, depending on what kind of a program you come through, they may or may not teach you an effective score studying system. You know, and as I said, everybody might do things a little bit different, but, you know, studying a score and reading a score is a little bit like reading a language. The more you use it, the more it will speak to you. And so if your symbols are consistent, then they're going to work for you more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I know you suggest the Dale Carnegie for relationships yeah. and all the other stuff we've got to do. Are there any other books or resources that you like to suggest?
Yeah. So one of them is the David Daniels Orchestral Music. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there is a big blue volume, and in many ways the print edition is gone obsolete because there's now David Daniels Orchestral Music online, and it's wonderful. You can go in and you can type in all sorts of different kinds of parameters to bring up pieces. And then there is also a volume, and I don't know if she's ever updated it, but it's by a woman by the name of Lucy Manning, and it's Pops Music in print. And it's also a very, very useful volume. And of course, you know, especially with Pops Music, you don't always are able to find instrumentation and things for combinations of pieces, which makes it a lot more challenging to program effectively. In terms of making sure you have the right numbers. And so that's a very, very useful volume. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, I use that. I think that, you know, as far as music research, I think every conductor should own a Groves dictionary in some way, shape, or form. I happen to have volumes of it sitting right here on my shelf, but there's also an online version of it. And, you know, because, you know, that's, I mean, you can find a lot of stuff online, of course, of information about pieces and composers. But at least, you know, when you've got volumes that are tried and true, you can be pretty assured that the information is going to be accurate, which I think is a helpful thing. You know, and then I also very much like to have a couple of volumes about operas, stories. You know, so, you know, when I'm working on an opera, I can actually look at the libretto and I can look at, you know, synopsis. So I know what I'm dealing with there. I have a couple, but perhaps the most fun is by a gentleman by the name of Dennis Forman, F-O-R-M-A-N, called A Night at the Opera. And, you know, he does it like similar to other opera books, except he's very irreverent about it. So, you know, so for example, you know, when he's describing the story of La Boheme, you know, he says, so when he discovers Mimi, you know, what does he do? What every other guy does, he gives her, he basically tells her his resume, you know, and so, you know, but he also, you know, he goes through and he says, well, here are the high points, here's the best music that you should be listening for in the operas and stuff. And, so, you know, it's always fun to be looking at that. And then, you know, I have, you know, things like the New York Philharmonic, program note guide, which is a volume that's been around for years. I have Beethoven companions and, books on, various composers and whatnot. But those are pretty much my, my go-to sources. There are some other books that are out there that I think are very, very useful for conductors that are not necessarily music related, other than the Dale Carnegie book. Diane Whitry, who is a colleague of mine that I've known for years, created a book called, Beyond the Score. She talks about all the other stuff in the conducting business that you ought to know that has nothing to do with music making.
Yeah, and she has a workshop based on the book now also.
Yeah, and so I think that's very, very useful, because when you're in school, you have time to learn how to be a conductor as far as, the musician, the studying of scores and the prep and so on and so forth. But there's so much more to this business that, you either are going to learn it the hard way or you're not going to survive. and you really, really do need to learn it. So.
So you've already mentioned that we don't, we don't look forward to the future.
Yeah.
Enough. Is there anything else, or maybe some things that we do that we shouldn't be doing?
Well, I think that, the history of music is based on human interaction. Mm-hmm. And, I always congratulate orchestral musicians, or for that matter, any instrumentalist, on the fact that they're willing to put away their PDAs or cell phones or anything else for hours and hours at a time to focus on an instrument. And it's really interesting, because we can talk about focus and what a younger generation is and the length of time that they're actually able to focus. And you think about it. If we're doing an orchestral piece that is 12 minutes long, what else are you doing in your life that you actually have to focus that much for 12 straight minutes? And, you're going to be hard pressed to come up with something that says, I took an SAT test, that took me a couple of hours. And they go, but you're only answering one question at a time, and then your head can come out of it, and then you can go back in. But the focus that's required, 12-minute piece, 15-minute piece. How about those people who sit down and play an opera where, now you're being able to focus, you're being asked to focus for an hour and 15 minutes at a time before there's a break. And, and I think that for young people, that kind of ability should not be discounted. Because, what's going to end up happening is that either you're going to learn to do it or you're not. And, and that's one of the problems with a push button society, which just, where things are happening so quickly that, we as a generation, meaning, a younger generation, can you sit down and for 2 hours do nothing but just look at your music, and it's more of a challenge because there's always distractions, believe it or not, it's one of the reasons why sometimes I like to study my score at Starbucks, because, I'm not at home. So my phone's not ringing. I turn my phone off. It's not my environment. So there's nothing else for me to focus on other than my scores. It's also one of the reasons why, interestingly enough, I like to travel and I'm alone in a hotel room, because suddenly all the stuff that is mine has been removed and all I have is the stuff that I brought with me. And I think that for young people, especially in a cultural norm, which is moving so fast. And of course, we know that we see two people who are communicating to each other, sitting next to each other, texting each other. They're not talking to each other, they're texting each other, and when you think about it, if we are going to be able to report the human condition at any point in history through the music of a particular composer, We have to understand what the human condition is. And if we're not communicating with people, how are we going to do that? I mean, we're all method actors. You know, how do we communicate pain if we've never felt pain? Okay. How do we communicate suffering if we've never suffered before? And I'm not saying that, you know, you should go out and cut your finger so that you experience pain, but you know, that's just living life. And we become more and more insulated from the human condition by what we do, because we sit in front of a computer screen, we sit in front of a, you know, iPad. And I mean, it's, you know, and, you know, and interestingly enough, you know, we can get into the idea of, you know, what is the personality makeup of a typical musician and conductor. And I'm here to tell you that I would believe that for the most part, it's going to be somebody who is an extrovert and introvert. Okay? So what does that mean? That means that this is somebody who is absolutely comfortable sitting for hours on end by themselves, focusing on something, okay, that they like to do. Okay? And that might be reading, and that might be studying your scores. Okay? But especially for the conductor to stand up on the podium and now flip a switch and say, now I'm going to become Mr. or Mrs. Personality. Okay. And you have to, because you're trying now to sell this piece of music that may not be easy to somebody. And, you know, and you've got, you know, you have a real challenge there. And that's why I say that, you know, that to me, the most successful ones are the ones who are extroverted introverts. I mean, they have an extroverted sense to them. They can make that come on. But, you know, if you really want to choose something between going to a party or sitting at home reading, guess what? You know, some people are going to choose sitting at home reading because, you know, I just typical of me, I'll go to a party and oh, my word, you know, just let's go back to talk about the stuff that they don't teach you at, in conducting school. What about cultivating donors? Okay. So what that means is that you have to sit there now using the Dale Carnegie principles, and you need to find out what makes these people tick, what makes them interested in what you're doing, and what is going to get them to want to give money to your organization. Okay. And that, you know, that's a special skill in itself. But hobnobbing, interacting with donors, okay, for the introvert, it's exhausting, you know, and, you know, you can do it for a while. And then after that, you go home and you go, I just need to veg, you know, and, you know, it's part of the job. Okay. And, but at least understanding the personality and for yourself, you know, you'll figure out ways to get that to happen. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Whether going to a party or staying home reading, sometimes it just depends on the day.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're doing. I mean, if all you've been doing is sitting home and reading, you're going to be ready to party.
Yeah.
You know, if all you've been doing is been out in the world interacting with people, you're going to be ready to go home. You know, whereas, you know, somebody who is an extrovert through and through, you know, they may be interacting with people all the time. Oh, let's go to a party. Sure. You know, they're ready to go because, you know, because they feed off of that, you know, that actually gives them energy.
Now, I know we're probably running short on time, but Jeremy had mentioned that you had taken the sabbatical to go study teaching of conducting at different schools.
Yes.
How did that go? Like what were some of the things you found that you thought were really interesting?
Well, has Jeremy told you the name of the article that I'm writing?
He has not.
This, Jeremy?
I don't think I know now.
Yeah. The name of the article is going to be Brahms Will Be Dead If We Do Not Start Conducting Ourselves Better. And it was a very interesting exercise. I went to some big famous schools, and I went to some schools that you've never heard of. And what I found was extraordinarily interesting, because the people who were doing it best had small classes, no surprise, but they were the ones at some small schools, and the exercises that they were actually having the students do as music educators was fantastic. And then I was at a very, very famous school who somebody went up and conducted the exposition of the Beethoven First Symphony. And then the next person came up to conduct it and borrowed that person's score. And then the next person came up and borrowed that person's score. And I mean, and I was shocked. I was absolutely aghast. And you know, and I understand where this class was coming from, and I understood the philosophy, and yet, you know, these people were conducting an orchestra in their head. They weren't really conducting what was in front of them as a result of that. And so I was in a class where they were about midway through the semester, and they were having trouble getting Londonderry Air started, because it starts on two. And then if they got that started, then the connecting teacher would say to them, you know, that needs a little more schmaltz. I'm not sure how useful that was. Yeah. And then, you know, there was, you know, as I said, it was really interesting. You know, and I was in different parts of the country. I was down in Texas. I was on the East Coast. I was in, Oregon. You know, as I said, every place was a little bit different. And, you know, and it's one of the things that has occurred to me is that there is no codification of the teaching of conducting skills. And at CSU, we are now starting to look at this really carefully so that the conducting faculty has a clear sense of what are the skills that you need to learn in year one of conducting class, and what are the skills you need to learn in year two of conducting class, okay? And then if you're lucky, maybe you actually have a third semester of conducting, but many schools do not, you know, at the undergraduate level. And I'm thinking that, you know, as I'm starting to, you know, push into the later years of my career, that, you know, I've become more and more of an educator and teacher conductor. And of course, from the summer master's degree program, I see people in, you know, all levels of ability coming in. And, you know, at some point, I'm going to have to just sit down and start writing, because, you know, there are marvelous textbooks about conducting, and yet, you know, nobody's learning conducting from a book. It's going to be under the tutelage of somebody who has a watchful eye and says, this will work, that's not going to work. This is going to work, that's not going to work. And it's really interesting because, you know, there are people who have gone someplace and, you know, I can only say that they've drank some kind of Kool-Aid because a teacher has told them, do it this way, do it this way, do it this way. And they think that after that, they've learned something this way, that it's the only way that it could be done. And that's absolutely not true. You know, there are multiple solutions to everything, you know, and, you know, Jeremy will tell you that, you know, you'll probably remember in class that if you had a left-handed cutoff that looked like this, okay, what's that called? The roundhouse cutoff. And that's the only cutoff you have, because that's the only one you were ever taught, you're going to find that there are places where you're not going to be able to move that fast enough to get your ensemble to cut off in a musical situation. And so I will tell a student saying, well, that's fine. When you come back to class next time, I want to see four different cutoffs. I want to see you come back with four different ways that you might do a cutoff in this particular spot. You know, and it just, it takes a little thought on people's parts, but, you know, being a conductor is very much being creative. And, you know, yep, I mean, we want to recreate a composer's score, but we have to be creative in finding solutions because every ensemble is different. Every ensemble has its own challenges. Every ensemble will learn different things faster than others. And you know, we talked about something which is don't rehearse from the hotel room. And what that means is that don't look at a score and say, aha, we're going to have issues in this place, and therefore I'm going to go right to that when we get into rehearsal. And then you go there, and your entire rehearsal is based upon this issue, and you get there, and there's no issue. Okay, they play it just fine. Now what are you going to do? So, you know, we want to train conductors to be flexible, have multiple solutions, but above all, they need to be able to think on their feet. You know, we can teach people technical ways to conduct music, but unless you are actually able to hear what's going on, identify the issues, and then the most important part is to make recommendations on solutions. Okay? If you're conducting the Chicago Symphony, you say, this is an issue, and they'll fix it. But if you are conducting several levels down, and I'm not just talking about education ensembles, I'm talking about professional ensembles, having solutions, you're going to get things done a whole lot faster. And that's what I mean by thinking on your feet. That's why I think that, you know, it's just, I mean, the experience that Jeremy, you know, had, you know, to conduct Recitative the first time, you have no choice than to think on your feet because you are not in control of your vocalist. And I think that, you know, it's a scary thought that one strata of the texture that you're dealing with is not under your control. You're actually trying to make a whole bunch of people work with that person. And learning recitative will also teach you how to accompany, you know? And so, I mean, I think that there's a lot there that can be learned. And sure, it's intimidating at first, especially people who are trying it for the first time. But, I mean, I also teach recitative in such a way that there's a system that, you know, you can learn how to get things done until you develop the ear and the motor skills to make it go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I've been fairly successful with that as well.
Yeah, it's a good system. I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, you'll get to use that system, you know, firsthand coming up. But, you know, if there's anything else that you guys need from me, you know, we can set up another appointment. We're happy to talk more.
Well, it was great to have this time. Yeah, I was happy to meet you.
All right. Nice to meet you. All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podium Time. You can find show notes for this episode and all of our other episodes at podiumtimepod.wordpress.com. Be sure to join our mailing list there or on our Facebook page at facebook.com/podiumtimepod. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligorati.